Thank you. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, one God, amen. Thank you guys for coming to Bible study. We are in the Old Testament book of Nehemiah. We are in chapter 4 today. And just in a summary, if you remember, Nehemiah was a cupbearer to the king in exile, and through the grace of God, he had led people to Jerusalem with the purpose of rebuilding the wall of Jerusalem. We saw last chapter that Abuna Andrew gave us, led us in this Bible study, and what we found was Nehemiah had set out plans of exactly what parts of the wall of the city of Jerusalem was going to be rebuilt by which people. And so as a leader, he had a really great plan of how to do it. So this plan involved, really surveying the wall, all its different sections, and then understanding who it is that's going to be building it. So that's where we left off last time. And as we saw, everyone was working together. But as we know, back then and in real life today, what happens when good work is going on? When good work to rebuild or to build something of God, there is opposition. And that's where we find ourselves in chapter 4. Again, this book, Nehemiah, is a fantastic example of a leader. So we have a lot of lessons in this chapter about what we do when we face opposition, because we're all going to face opposition. So because we don't have any working microphones, please forgive me. I'm just going to read some of the verses, and then we'll discuss them and talk about them. So chapter 4 begins, "But it so happened when Sanballat heard that we were rebuilding the wall, that he was furious and very indignant and mocked the Jews. And he spoke before his brethren and the army of Samaria and said, 'What are these feeble Jews doing? Will they fortify themselves? Will they offer sacrifices? Will they complete it in a day? Will they revive the stones from the heaps of rubbish, stones that are burned?'" So here we find the first example of opposition. Sanballat, as we know, was the governor of Samaria. And Samaria was the land that, was very powerful, and it was right by Jerusalem. So we had discussed in prior chapters that opposition from the nearby tribes and different peoples was happening already, because they each had their own reason to oppose the rebuilding of the walls of Jerusalem. Some of it is they wanted Jerusalem to remain weak. Some of it was for political reasons, for reasons of trade, for reasons of worship, all of that. So there was an inherent reason in each of these people to oppose this. But we find here that this is the time where Nehemiah is at the moment of execution of this well-laid plan, and he faces opposition. He immediately faces opposition. What type of opposition is it? What is it? It's ridicule. It's mockery, right? So the nearby governor begins to mock them. And this is a pretty well-laid out type of opposition. So as we read this, obviously this is an Old Testament story, but there's a lot that relates to our life. So when we look and say, Jerusalem, the building of Jerusalem's wall, this is, if we look at our spiritual life, our Jerusalem, the temple of God in us, in our bodies, in our minds, in our hearts, it's very similar. Who opposes? It's not the governor of Samaria, it's Satan. Satan is going to oppose us when we want to rebuild the spiritual walls of our life. And so the first tactic that Satan uses is mockery, right? We see this. We see that by ridiculing, which, by the way, is quite prevalent today. We find that today, especially in the times of social media, in the past, people would have to actually like walk up to you to ridicule you, the schoolyard bully, the jerk at the office, like whatever it is. But now it takes on a much more insidious form where people just feel emboldened to ridicule people online without ever seeing them, knowing them, or whatever. The most immediate thing to anything that anyone posts is you go to the comments section and there's just this kind of mockery that's going on. How could they do this? Who is this? How do they mock the way they look, they mock the way they act, they mock what they say. So mockery is something that Satan uses against us as a very important tactic, because mockery and ridicule causes something in some of us, which is fear. So if I am presenting a Bible study that's being live streamed and we open the comments section, and some people then starts to negatively comment, this guy, Tony, doesn't know what he's talking about. Okay? That, if this speaker starts to read it or others start to read it, they could be like, wow, this is kind of worrisome or scary. See, Satan's already been defeated, right? Satan's been defeated. And yet his tactic that he often uses is to scare us. And that scare comes from, you know, the opposition of, who do you think you are? You think you can handle this? Do you think you could do this? Now, Sanballat was interesting because why would he resort to name-calling? Right? He's obviously angry. He's obviously angry when he sees that this is happening. Sanballat sees that the wall of Jerusalem is going to get rebuilt. Why is he resorting to this type of attack? If Sanballat did not believe this was possible, would he waste his time? No, he wouldn't waste his time. But something inside of him told him, Nehemiah, this man, came here with a decree and permission from the king and supplies and people, and now they've got a plan. This could really happen. And so that sometimes is the opposition of mockery, we can look at it and say, oh my gosh, this is so scary. Well, who am I really? This, and like completely fold under that kind of pressure. Or we can start to think through that this is an attack from Satan, perhaps, you know, putting these ideas into other people's minds. And if I am being emboldened and empowered by God to do God's work, that this should not scare me. And if anything, the person who is scared is likely the one who is mocking. It's sort of a classic first opposition tactic by the devil. And so let's continue reading here. So in verse 3, he says, now Tobiah the Ammonite was beside him. And he said, so beside who? Beside Sanballat. So not only is the governor of Samaria, but now Tobiah the Ammonite, another group of people and their leader, was beside him and said, whatever they build, if even a fox goes up on it, he will break down their stone wall. Like that's like old times kind of mockery, right? Like if they put something, even a little fox is going to knock it over. And here we see that often if you see someone opposing you with mockery, what can we also expect? I point you back to the example of a comment section of a post. Say someone puts a really nice post about, oh, some very wholesome, nice thing. I spent time with my family, or, oh, this is great, we were at church, or whatever. Oh, look, we're building a new church, something like that. In the comment section, someone says something negative. Expect that often other people will join in. That kind of opposition is common. And that's what Tobiah did. He doubled down. He just went, oh yeah, if they put anything on these stones, a little fox will knock it over, right? So it's contagious. Others will chime in. Again, this is really a playbook of what we see happening since the beginning of time. And then first it's a psychological warfare, as you can see here. Right? Psychological means trying to mock and incite fear in the person trying to lead a godly life or do a godly mission. So let's see how Nehemiah responds. Verse 4. This is Nehemiah now. Hear, O our God, for we are despised. turn their reproach on their own heads and give them as plunder to a land of captivity. Do not cover their iniquity and do not let their sin be blotted out from before you, for they have provoked you to anger before the builders." Wow. So this is a prayer to God that Nehemiah does. And why do you think this is? Like, why does Nehemiah pray this prayer? First, notice that Nehemiah's answer, after being mocked publicly by various leaders, is not to respond to those leaders. Where is his response to God? His immediate response was not, "Oh yeah, watch." He doesn't say anything to these people. But he looks directly toward God, and then he doesn't say, "Oh gosh, maybe we should stop," or "What do you think, God?" Or, "God, please forgive them. They don't know what they're saying." Just, you know, what is his response? His response is often a response of a leader. The leader is emboldened. Why is he emboldened? Why is this man, Nehemiah, emboldened? Like, who is this guy? I mean, let's be honest. Nehemiah was a cupbearer. It's not like he was a born leader. Right? Like, we don't know. Like, he not had leadership training. He never had a high position of where he led the troops or was a governor of some big area. Like, he was a cupbearer. He tasted drink and food and handed it to the king. So he doesn't really have a lot of training, which we see often in God's work, right? God doesn't always choose the highest positioned people to do his job, right, for him. He chose a cupbearer. That's why he's emboldened. He's emboldened because God commissioned him to do this. And so what does he do? He's emboldened and he talks to God. And he talks to God and he tells God, almost in anger, right? Like, these are the people, you know, remember, like, his prayer to God is not, "Please forgive them." What does he say? Like, "Wipe them out, God." Like, they're doing this to you, God. To you. Like, you should be angered with them. You should do that. And so here, you know, the concepts to learn in leadership is, one, don't waste your time arguing with foolish people, right? If somebody is arguing with you and they're mocking and they're saying things that are going to try to oppose you or derail you, in doing God's work, take it to God first. And when you take it to God, it's okay to be impassioned if this is the work he commissioned for you. If God says, "Build this church," and we face opposition in building the church, where the first response when the opposition comes is not to sit there and, like, complain about it or argue with the people that are, like, bringing opposition. So take it to God. Say, "God, you want this church built? This is your house. And now look, God, the people that are here ready to build your house, this is happening in front of them. You like this, God?" And that approach sometimes we see in people that are very close to God, that spend so much time talking to God. They've developed a closeness to him that allows them this almost this freedom of expression when they are opposed by others. You know, we see this sometimes in very holy people as they talk to God or the saints. Sometimes, like, you know, you hear these stories of, you know, someone comes and, like, does something, like, desecrates an icon or something like that. You see a very holy person looking, like, there's a story of a very holy person who saw this happening. Somebody came into the Church of St. George and, like was spitting on an icon of the Theotokos. So this holy person looked at St. George and says, "You like this? You like what he's doing to your mother?" And then immediately St. George responds, right? Why? Because their closeness. He's close to St. George. He's close to the Theotokos. He's close to God. So Nehemiah's response here, after spending so much time with God, is to say, "Agbekida." Like, this is your commission. And it's okay for us to act like that. It's okay for us to beg and ask God and to say, you know, don't let this happen. This is your work. And that's exactly here what Nehemiah does. He asks God, and then he, you know, like when Nehemiah mentions this sort of like provoking God in front of God's people, you notice that in the verse? He sort of mentions it. Like Satan does this all the time, right? Satan like makes empty threats, and even like when Satan himself is defeated, he sort of makes these empty like, you can't do this, you can't do this, right? And he tries to oppose us by scaring us and making us lose hope. So what Nehemiah is saying to God is, this is happening in front of your people. Like, encourage your people. Don't let them lose heart, God. Because Nehemiah as a leader also knows that the people may not have his type of faith, right? Many times leaders, even though they're so emboldened with a task or a mission, they also have to work with others. Nehemiah is not going to be the one rebuilding the entire wall by himself. He cannot. He's the coach, if you will, right? He's the manager. He's that kind of leader. So one of the things he asked God is like, help these people. Don't let this happen in front of them. And it's a beautiful example for us when we hear like this kind of thing being said by Nehemiah, like calling on to God to not let other people on our team, our family, our coworkers, our colleagues lose hope in a really important work that God has put them through, or God has commissioned. So we continue in verse 6. So we built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height, for the people had a mind to work. What a beautiful statement, right? That's lesson two, right? So the, one of the lessons, well, I don't even know if it's lesson two. There's many lessons here, but another lesson we learn is, what happened? Did he stop working? No. He says, and we built the wall, like up to half its height. We built it. Like we got to half the height we wanted. So we were continuing to work. We weren't going to let this stop us. And that's what a great leader does, right? A godly leader gets back to work. Like this is happening. You know this opposition is happening. You bring it to God. You're not going to waste your time arguing with foolish people, says so in Proverbs, and you just continue the work. And the work went on. And then sometimes this is where the problems stop, right? Sometimes the problem just stops there. The opposition stops. Somebody opposes us. We bring it to God, and we say it's not going to derail us, and we're going to continue working. And we do, and the opposition stops. But at other times, it doesn't stop. As a matter of fact, at other times, the problem gets worse. And we see this in many examples in the lives of saints, right? Saint Anthony the Great, one of my favorites. This happens. It starts with a psychological warfare, right? In your mind, Anthony, who do you think you are? You're just going to go into the desert. What's going to happen to your sister? You can't just leave the world, you know. And then when Anthony was determined and continued, the opposition went from psychological to physical, to an actual attack physically. Something happens where the devil can move people to go from mockery to actual physical resistance. And so this is what happens in the following verses. So they got to work, they built the wall, and the entire wall was joined together up to half its height. So, because remember, there was areas of the wall that had big gaping holes, so they fixed those areas, and at least the entire wall now was connected up to half the height they wanted, right? And then verse 7, now it happened when Sanballat, Tobiah, the Arabs, the Ammonites, the Ashdodites. So now there's a lot more people, right? It was first the Samaritan governor and Tobiah the Ammonite, but now there's Arabs, there's Ashdodites. They heard that the walls of Jerusalem were being restored and the gaps were beginning to be closed, that they became very angry. And all of them conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem and create confusion. So this is another lesson. When mockery doesn't work, and the enemy then starts to do what? start to gang up. Happened to St. Anthony when he went into the tombs, right? The tombs. And he was living in the tombs. The devils then ganged up on him. They came together, attacking him physically with not only scary sights, but then beatings, physical beatings. And this here, this physical plan of resistance and harm was what these nearby people were planning on doing. They were getting ready to attack. They said, "We are so angry that these people are actually now connected the pieces of the wall and they're doing it. We can't let this happen. We are going to do it." Now remember, God had asked the Israelites before the exile to destroy these people. That was God's intention. As the Israelites went into the area, he said, "Leave nothing, leave no one, take nothing." Right? But the Israelites didn't always listen. And thereby, they went into exile and so on. So these people have been around now, and they're ready to destroy the good work that Nehemiah is doing, is leading. So this is a classic other lesson now. So it starts with psychological warfare. What do we expect then? Negative people bonding together to stop the good work and the good people. We should plan on that. Should plan on that. We should plan on if the scare tactics and mockery and ridicule doesn't work, that sometimes people will start to band together and want to do harm to the people of God. This is something that we've always known. And this is happening not because they're horrible people, but because the devil doesn't want work to happen. So he will put those people to have ideas to harm us. This is not uncommon for Satan to do these things. As a matter of fact, temptations and, you know, the attacks by Satan are expected for our entire life. We should expect that. Again, St. Anthony said, expect temptation until your last breath. Like, this was sort of like his parting words. Like, understand that this is going to happen. And so, you know, this resistance to the work, expecting opposition, and then what? Do you think then Nehemiah said, let's stop the work? No, he shows us another example of a great leader where Nehemiah then takes it seriously and begins to take action, right? So there are many examples from Scripture, Old Testament and New, about when we start the good work of God, things sometimes look like they're getting worse, right? What's an example from the Old Testament? The story of the Israelites in the land of Egypt, right? It's a classic story. Moses is called by God to get the people out of Egypt from slavery. Moses goes to Pharaoh and says, God says, let my people go. What did Pharaoh do? Oh yeah? They're not going to get straw to make bricks. We're going to make their life even harder. And it got so bad that the people said, what are you doing, Moses? We're better off without you. Like, why? Moses himself even asked God, like, why is this happening? Like, why me? Like, why is this? Like, can you make this better? But this is a time where we can reflect on why certain things like this happen. Because a natural response is that human beings don't want to have it hard. No one wants to have a hard life. No one wants to have to face opposition. Let's face it, nobody wants that. But God allows that sometimes. And why does God allow that? Imagine if when Moses went and said to Pharaoh, God says, let my people go. And Pharaoh said, go for it. There you go. There would not have been a story there. Not just a story that lived on for centuries. So when the people around the Israelites saw them, they're like, whoa, those are those people with that God. Didn't you hear what happened? The plagues on Egypt. Egypt, the most powerful civilization. Pharaoh, the most powerful of them all, sank to the bottom of the sea. Like, this is those people. Sometimes opposition happens so that when God chooses to bring a solution, it is that obvious. And many times we think the solution will be earthly, right? Like, oh yeah, we're going to get opposed at work by somebody who's really mean to us. Say we have a boss who's not nice or whatever is happening. And then, like, truth be told, we are vindicated and we take a position of power even above that boss. Doesn't always work like that, right? This beautiful icon of the 21 martyrs of Libya who we celebrated their feast recently, right? These are young men who were very poor, who went to another country to do very poor person's work so they can send money back to their very poor families. They never made that money home. They never got back home. They were killed on a beach in Libya in front of the whole world to see. But look where they're at now. So sometimes the work of God is not for glory in this life, but the work of God is definitely there. And we as leaders were asked to continue that work, but like Nehemiah, to make plans for it. Like, we don't stop the work and we plan on the opposition happening, and we have some determination that God is going to be with us through those challenges. We can continue reading. Let's see here. So we ended with verse 8. And they said, like, and they had all of them conspired together to come and attack Jerusalem and create confusion, right? This was part of the attack. It was like, let's scare them. Let's come together and create confusion so we derail their work. Nehemiah goes on to say, nevertheless, we made our prayer to our God, and because of them, we set a watch against them day and night. Verse 9 is beautiful. There's so much there, right? Nevertheless, like, despite the opposition, which is a very real threat, we made our prayer to our God. He didn't say, I pray to God. We made our prayer to our God. The people had been watching Nehemiah pray. They saw him as a leader. And then now it was time for them, because they're part of the good work, to do what their leader had shown them. They prayed together. They put their requests in front of God in prayer. And then they did something. They set a watch against them meaning the enemies, day and night. Right? So they began to say, we're going to work, but we're also going to keep a watch out for these enemies in case they attack us in the work. That's really important. That's part of a tactic that is very, very meaningful for us. When we expect attack by the enemy, we should be watchful for it. But what is said here mimics the words of our Lord when he said, watch and pray, right? Watch and pray. So they were praying and they were watching. They were practicing this age-old practice of godly people, which is pray and watch for the enemy's attacks. Verse 10 says, then Judah said, Judah are the people of Nehemiah. Then Judah said, Judah's not a person, the strength of the laborers is failing, and there is so much rubbish that we're not able to build the wall. And our adversaries said, they will neither know nor see anything till we come into their midst and kill them and cause the work to cease. So it was when the Jews who dwelt near them came that they told us 10 times, from whatever place you turn, they will be upon us. Oof. Whoa. There's a lot there, right? So the people themselves started saying, the laborers, they're getting tired. And there's so much garbage around, we can't even get to continue building. And then the enemy started to say, you won't know what hits you. We're about to come at you, and you won't know where we're coming from, right? Again, the attacks continue. But during those attacks, the people, despite praying and watching, are getting tired. They're in the middle of the work. This is a classic, again, point to contemplate. Imagine you're running a really long race, and you've trained for it, right? We know people that run marathons. I am certainly not one of those people, but there are some people who do this. And you start out the race, you have a lot of energy, you're excited, and you're moving. And you're doing really well. And at the end of the race, you see the finish line, or it's close, and you get this sort of added thrust of energy to just finish the work. But what happens in the middle? The middle is where you get tired. The middle is where it drags. The middle is where you start to think, I'm going to give up. I can't do this anymore. Whose crazy idea was it to sign up for this marathon? I'm not going to do this. I'm going to die out here on this road. Like, all these thoughts start to come to mind. Like, and this is exactly what's happening. In the middle of the work, as the opposition's coming, people are tired. Now the opposition starts telling them, oh, we're going to come at you. You know, we're going to come at you from every, you won't even know what hit you. And what's worse is now the Jews, there were Jews living around there. They start getting in on the mockery. Like, they told us, it says here, then they told us 10 times, from whatever place you turn, they will be upon us. Like, how demoralizing is that? It's so demoralizing that the people telling you 10 times, if somebody told me something 10 times, I'm done. Imagine I'm running that marathon and somebody's in my, you're going to die, dude. You're not going to make it. Look at you. You can barely take a breath. You taste blood in your mouth. You're just not going to make it. And they say this 10 times halfway through the race. There is a very good chance I'm going to be like, I'm going to stop. I can't do this. So this is the opposition. This is what's expected. This here is a classic, again, I use that word a lot. It's a very common and well-known trick that Satan uses when we are in the middle of striving to carry on good work and it's dragging out and we're tired and we've been watching for the opposition and we are praying and things don't seem to be getting any better. Expect the naysayers to come piling it on. Just expect that. And, you know, like this, again, it's sort of the idea of like the people starting to grumble and they're being affected, right? They're affected by these threats. And the discouragement that often happens halfway through a project, a work. The Jews telling them 10 times, that is an example of rumors, right? They start to echo off each other a bunch of rumors. You're never going to make it. Are you kidding me? They can come at us from every place. You're never going to be able to be protected. So people start to believe it. And the threats are starting to get to the people, right? The threats are starting to get to Nehemiah's people. And so, you know, what does Nehemiah do? As a leader, sometimes leadership is difficult because the leader may have a mindset to move forward. We're going to do this work. Just going to do it. Ignore the rumors. We said we're going to watch and we're going to continue working and that's all we're going to do. Nehemiah may have had such faith in God's protection that he could have done that, right? He could have said, we're just going to work, ignore the rumors. But as a good leaders listen to the people. They listen. They try to understand the fears of the people around them. The people on our team, our family members, those of our loved ones, our friends that are going through difficult times, they may not have the fortitude to carry through, and we need to listen to that. We need to spend time trying to understand what the people are saying. So Nehemiah listens, and this is what he does in verse 13. Therefore, I, as the leader now, I positioned men behind the lower parts of the wall at the openings, and I set the people according to their families with their swords, their spears, and their bows. And I looked and arose and said to the nobles, to the leaders, and to the rest of the people, do not be afraid of them. Remember the Lord, great and awesome. Fight for your brethren and your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. What a powerful speech. What a powerful little verse, right? There's two verses there. First, he listened, then he takes action. He understands the weakness. The weakness are these gaps and these low parts of the wall. I'm going to position people there to help protect that. And then he calls on the people and says, this isn't my idea. This isn't my ask of you. This is God's ask of us. So he calls on the people to bring together their families. And this is a really important example of what that is. Many times as leaders, you have to call on the strengths of others. And the strengths of the others are exactly that. They are your family, your friends, your loved ones. Here he says, you guys are not fighting for some idea that I came up with. You're fighting here. It says here, fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. This is yours. He's calling to encourage them to take arms. And he put them with their swords and their spears and their bows. Nehemiah had a plan, once he listened to the people, to fortify the weakness and to call upon the people's strengths. This is another wonderful example of leadership. When we are facing attacks and we're going through that middle of the road, the middle part of the race that's so hard to endure, we call upon our loved ones, we ask our friends, we ask our Christian brothers and sisters, we ask our families, and we ask them to stand by us because we are weak alone. You don't want to go through those really difficult battles alone if you can bring people around you that would help you, support you, walk that walk with you. And that's here what Nehemiah does. He calls upon the people, and he arms the people, and he tells them why they're fighting. Continuing on, let's see here. And it happened when our enemies heard that it was known to us and that God had brought their plan to nothing, that all of us returned to the wall, everyone to his work. So it was from that time on that half of my servants worked at construction while the other half held the spears, the shields, the bows, and wore armor. And the leaders were behind all of the house of Judah. Wow. So here, once it became known that the enemies was like, hey, they've got it figured out, he didn't stop. He didn't slow down the work. He actually had called upon the people, and they came up with a plan. Half of them were going to build, and the other half was going to protect, night and day. The work itself was not going to stop. They weren't going to stop and fight the enemy, and they weren't going to ignore the enemy and just do the work of building. They were going to do both. And those, it says here, the leaders started to become behind this idea. He was able to garner support from, like, the leaders or the ones that have influence. In any group of people that you may lead, there are the influence there are those who influence others. They may not have a leadership position, but you get them on your side and they'll be able to fully back it, and you will see success happen much faster. It says, those who built on the wall and those who carried burdens loaded themselves so that with one hand they worked at construction and with the other they held a weapon. Every one of the builders had his sword girded at his side as he built, and the one who sounded the trumpet was beside me. That's interesting, right? So Nehemiah doesn't go to sleep. He's walking that wall, and he's got a trumpeter next to them. And the people have a sword and construction equipment, and they are moving forward with rebuilding this wall. Then I said to the nobles, the rulers, and the rest of the people, the work is great and extensive, and we're separated far from one another on the wall. Wherever you hear the sound of the trumpet, rally to us there. Our God will fight for us. This is another plan, right? He realizes the point of attack can come from any side, and we may be outnumbered there. Listen for the trumpet. If the trumpet sounds, leave what you're doing and come help us. Again, being strategic and planning for the opposition and what the opposition is going to bring at them. We need to do the same. Our opposition comes from Satan for our spiritual life. We need to understand where our weaknesses are. If I asked us, where is the weakness in your wall? Would you know? Would I know where the weakness in my family is? Would I know where the weakness at my workplace is? Spiritually, now I'm talking. And then fortifying that weakness so that I don't fall. And when attacks come, I'm not alone. I know I can trumpet to my, you know, like my support, and my support will come and help. And it says, our God will fight for us. That's the most important piece of that verse. So come help us, but know that we're not alone. Drop the work you're doing if you hear the trumpet. Come help, but know that God will fight for us. So the last part of this chapter, it says, so we labored in the work, and half of the men held the spears from daybreak until the stars appeared. The same time I also said to the people, let each man and his servant stay at night in Jerusalem, that they may be our guard by night and a working party by day. So neither I, my brethren, my servants, nor the men of the guard who followed me took off our clothes, except that everyone took them off for washing. And that's like, you know, the biggest testimony to how important that work was, that the plan of protection to stick together was nonstop, and it was nonstop till they finished the work. That another lesson for the important work you do, whatever it takes, do it to succeed. Nehemiah and his people didn't even change their clothes until the work was done. They stuck it out. They just took their clothes to wash them, and that's it. Like, they didn't go home to lounge and take shifts like 1 week at a time. You guys work this week, we'll work next week. They never left the wall. And finding a way to instill motivation in ourselves and those around us to finish the work. Finishing God's work is very rewarding, extremely rewarding. And having the understanding that we're all going to go through these valleys and even sometimes get so burned out or demoralized, that's where you call on people to help you. That's where good leaders understand that is going to happen in any journey and any service. Look at the church service, right? Every church service goes through periods of time where it's weakened. And then you call on others and God strengthens you until that work is finished. So struggling against sin can be to the point where we feel like we're going to give up. We're just going to give in to the sin. But, you know, St. Paul reminds us that the work of resisting sin is quite difficult, even to the point of bloodshed. So that is our main lesson here. We've learned from Nehemiah as a great example of a leader. We learned that the opposition from Satan to the work of God is going to happen, and that you have to have trust in God and a plan. And as a leader, you anticipate that you're going to go through difficult times, but to work very hard until that work is done. And so being willing to work to see the success that God provides us in our life. So that brings us to the end of the chapter. Chapter 5 next week is a beautiful chapter. Our brother Randy is going to be leading us into that chapter. But I will end it here if there are any questions. Otherwise, we'll stand up to pray. How old is Nehemiah? I don't think it's stated exactly how old he was. But we do know that he was born in exile. He wasn't part of the original group that was exiled to Babylon. So he was actually in Babylon, so he's probably middle-aged. He wasn't a very old person. And but it's not exact. I don't know exactly how old he was. Do you know, Randy? Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, let's stand up to pray.